Welcome to the Bungie Line. My name's Ted Hager.
And I'm Alex Barnett. And I just want to try something out, because I'm pretty sure that there's something else going on with that noise. You know that didgeridoo noise?
Yeah, the Bungie Line signature sound.
Yeah, no, we talked about it last time. And the time before that, if I recall. So, Ben, can you just do me a favor? Just play that backwards. Just turn up the volume. Let's just play that backwards there.
Oh, well, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
So we're back again with our interview with Jeremy Zawadny in part two of the interview, and we're going to move right on forward into talking about their MASH service as one of the things and wander through this interview through the end of it again. And were there any things that you wanted to call out about the interview?
I think it's going to be interesting to see what their take is on the social network space. And, you know, Jeremy does talk about how he sees it being different to some of the existing sites or services that are out there. I think that there's some innovation that they're talking through. And on the WebOS front.
The WebTop OS or whatever people often call it.
Yeah, it's, you know, Jeremy's always a good read, I think, for a blog post. He's not just punching the Yahoo line on everything, and he'll go out and share his thoughts
beats
around.
Beats the crap out of that idea, too, the whole WebOS idea on his blog.
Yeah, so, you know, we use this as an opportunity to find out what he meant.
So before we get into the interview, here's one of the things, though, about the whole social networking side of things. It seems like Yahoo's putting a big focus on this area of late. They've kind of like gotten recently that this is even more important. At least that's kind of the impression I've gotten from it, because a friend of ours actually ended up working over there as a product manager in social networking.
Corby Parnell. Well, yeah, and on the developer relations API. They've made acquisitions over the last 2 or 3 years that have had quite good foresight into where we're going with all this. You know, Flickr, Delicious, and they came along with these APIs.
StumbleUpon is another one that they grabbed not too long ago, right? And or no, that was eBay, I'm sorry, that grabbed that one.
Right.
But still, it goes to prove that Yahoo is really understanding it.
Yeah, well, apart from you being completely wrong about that point that you made, I think you're right.
Absolutely. And before I make a further fool of myself, shall we continue with the Jeremy Zawadny interview?
Let's do it.
All right.
Now, we're going to change the topic a little bit and talk about the social network news that came out just a few days ago around something called MASH.
That's right.
What's all that about?
So MASH is a new service that we launched, you know, a few days ago, I guess it was, publicly. And, you know, we've been obviously using it internally for a while now and playing with it. And it's an interesting twist on social networking and profiles and things like that. It's kind of hard, you know, everyone wants to compare it to something else, but it's hard to do that because it has features that are kind of like other things, but also very distinct. Some people want to compare it to, you know, Facebook or Friendster or whatever, and there are similarities, but there are some interesting differences too. The thing that's most interesting is the idea that by default, your friends can actually edit your profile, which kind of solves one of the problems I've seen with a lot of social networking sites is people get invited but don't put anything on their profile, have these very minimal profiles. But if you've got a really energetic friend who wants to update your profile for you, they can. They can add a background image to your page. They can fill in information about you. They can also add modules to your page. So if they want to add I'm trying to think, there's all these different modules you can add to the main section or to the right sidebar of the page. And they can go and add one of those. And, of course, you have the ability to go in and turn them off and change them and modify things yourself. You always get the final say. But the idea is your friends and your community can kind of help jumpstart your online presence in that way, which is kind of interesting because, you know, sometimes people have fun with it. They go in and they'll put a funny image on there or they'll update what they know about you. And it's almost kind of wiki-like in the sense that, you know, lots of people can contribute to a single page.
But, and for this to work, I presume one would have to have some friends, right?
That's right, exactly.
Man, that one's kind of rough. So, but the basic idea that
enemies.
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, it could go that way, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Start granting permission to people here. You can put stuff on my site because I know you hate me.
That's right.
So the idea on that though is, I've found, like, I've got a Facebook page, I've got a MySpace page, and both of them are in a horrible disarray, and there's really not any content on there worth anything. My LinkedIn page is really old. And so you're saying essentially that you would be granting your friends access to your page so that they can update and talk about you. So there's a nice narcissism element in it.
Oh, sure.
How has that worked for MASH? I mean, I haven't looked at their stuff yet. Has it actually been received well?
You know, I honestly can't say. I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to the team much about it. And, you know, I poked around and looked at a lot of profiles. And it's interesting because, you know, in some circles it seems that people just go nuts, you know, updating each other's profiles and adding little tidbits about each other or adding new modules that someone didn't know about. And other groups, they just kind of don't do it that much. So the flexibility is there, so people can do that, but it's not required at all. You know, people can use it like a generic sort of profile where you say a few things about yourself and upload a picture and you're done. And there's the sort of news feed in there as well, so you can find out what your friends are doing when they change their profile and all that.
It may be too early to say, but do you have any visibility or sense, at least, of where the API story is going to go with this? Because I think that's a potential differentiator as well.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. No, it is too early to say, but I think that there could be some really interesting things could get built with a good API on top of MASH. Yeah, no doubt about that.
I still end up with this horrible picture in my mind of those kind of, you know, young kids who take permanent marker and write on each other's heads while they're passed out drunk and things like that.
Yeah.
But
you could write the app that does that to people's profile pictures, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, another one that we wanted to discuss with you, from what we understand, you've had some involvement and some interest in the project, I guess an open source project called Hadoop. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, so I haven't actually contributed any code to it. I'm actually not a Java guy. It is primarily a Java project. But
you've spoken of it, though.
That's right, yeah. And I think it's a pretty important project. And effectively what we're doing is, you know, every company that's trying to attack these big problems nowadays with all the data on the web and amassing large amounts of data and hoping to analyze them has the same problem. And the problem is, how do you do that? And everyone sort of agrees that, you know, you don't go buy a mainframe. You buy a couple thousand computers and figure out a way to divide and conquer. So you have to distribute the work up among these thousands of computers, figure out how to aggregate the data back, and there's all sorts of...
The high-performance computing grid thing that's been going on with Linux.
Yeah, the whole grid computing model. And so everyone realizes that's the way to do it, but then you got to go out and invent your own software. And there's been some software in the academic world to do this, but it's really not packaged up in a way that's approachable to most developers that want to work on this kind of stuff. So Hadoop was a sort of brainchild of Doug Cutting from Lucene and other projects through the Apache Software Foundation. So he's an old-school search guy, and of course, search is one of the big problems that Hadoop can be used for. There are many, many others, too. So he started this project to say, well, why don't we just sort of use the best publicly available knowledge about how to techniques and strategies for doing this, build the software as an open-source project, and then anyone can have it. And so at Yahoo, of course, we've got that same problem, too, where we've got to come up with ways to make all this stuff work and looked around. And it's a classic problem for us because we always have infrastructure internally that duplicates an open source project in one way or another. You know, we've adopted more and more open source for use internally over the years, whether it was picking up the Apache web server many years ago or eventually moving to PHP for our front-end scripting or using MySQL as our relational database of choice. There's been a whole series of things like that. And in almost every case, it's not that we had simply adopted an open source technology, it's that we adopted an open source technology to replace our own technology that was either inferior or costly to support or whatever. And Hadoop is the same kind of thing. It's like, well, we could go and invest all this time and energy and build our own stuff, and it would work great for us, but we could contribute that back to the community at large, and then anyone else could use it. And in doing that, we get great software for ourselves, and we're also helping to commoditize that, so we're kind of lowering the barrier to entry for anyone else to come in and build something innovative and sort of advance the state of the art at the same time. So there's really multiple upsides for us and, you know, virtually no downside. And, you know, you get other interested and really talented people who want to work on the software, and some of them work on it on our paycheck, and other people are contributors from around the world who are just interested in it for their own needs or for their own companies. It's very much the traditional kind of open source development model.
There's still a little confusion I have in just looking at it. Is it really just a pure, like, mass processing, data crunching kind of thing? Because it looked like from the site they were talking about app hosting as well.
Well, I mean, you have to think about it in terms of layers of infrastructure and technology. You know, right now it's the main focus, last I looked, is making sure the basic functionality for basically being able to submit jobs and have the workload distributed among machines and results collected back and things like that is making, you know, getting that as optimized and predictable and manageable as possible. You know, you want to be able to make, you know, manage recovery from failure and all that kind of stuff. And then there are other add-on things too, like, gosh, wouldn't it be neat if we had a big distributed file system built on this code base as well? And once you get the basic building blocks in place, as of many things, people start thinking more abstractly. They try to move up a layer of abstraction or move up the stack and say, well, what could we build on top of this? What could we build on top of that? And some of those things end up being contributed back to the core project because they realize it still kind of falls within the vision of what the project should do. And then other things I'm sure will be available as contributed software or full-blown projects of their own that just simply require a Hadoop install before you can use them. And so there's a lot of discussion around Hadoop and what it could be used for in the future and what things people might want to build on it. And some of it is, as with most projects, probably getting ahead of itself. But there's definitely a very solid foundation that exists there today that people can start to build on. And we've been using it internally quite successfully.
What are the largest projects that you're aware of that are using Hadoop today, Jeremy?
I don't know. I mean, Doug would be a much better person to ask about that because he's got much more visibility into that. I know we've used it here on pretty good-sized clusters of machines, you know, in the many hundreds or thousands of nodes for workloads here that we have.
Right.
I don't know what the largest deployment of it would be today. That's a good question.
Let us start to wrap up here and just hit you with one other thing. Is Yahoo going to be working at delivering the WebTop OS?
Are we going to be? That's an interesting.
I'm baiting you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I see a lot of startups doing this WebOS thing and trying to. It's weird because they're trying to recreate the desktop on the web, and I think it's interesting and it's sort of a really good proof of how far the web technology has come. That you can try to mimic Mac OS 8 inside a web browser, and it kind of looks right and feels right, and you can get most of the behaviors the same and things like that. But you know, part of me is kind of wonders what the point is.
Yeah, there's that you can. It's gotten sophisticated enough that now you can actually do some of the things that it was never intended for and really isn't fit for anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, part of me says, who's going to use that? Because when I watch sort of normal people using websites and using things today, you know, most people who aren't technically savvy are confused. They don't a lot of times understand the difference between a web app and a desktop app as it is. Right, they just know that they open up their web browser and they do stuff, and they don't realize that some stuff's running on a remote server and some is running on the desktop. And when you try to make the remote website look and feel like the desktop and has movable windows and drag and drop and all this other stuff, it's, you know, we're really going to have confusing metaphors here, and I think it's going to be a real usability problem. But even putting that aside, you know, one of the things about the web is that things can be these loosely coupled apps that can be run on all sorts of different servers by different groups, and people can build the thing that they think they can do best. And then when companies come along and say, well, I'm going to build a web OS and anyone can plug into it, it's like, well, yeah, I guess you're trying to recreate what Microsoft did and just do it on the web. I think part of the problem with doing something like that is people dramatically underestimate how much investment and time and energy and thinking and how much trial and error and evolution goes into building a truly good operating system. You know, look at the Linux kernel, for example. You know, that's been around for well over 10 years now. And it's only in the recent few years with projects like, you know, Ubuntu coming out that people say, hey, this is getting to the point now where sort of normal people can try to use it. Now, trying to do that with the limited technology we have on the web with, you know, the server-side languages and the JavaScript and the client it's an interesting pursuit, but I don't know what the goal is.
Yeah, I've been looking at this area from a different perspective, which is not quite taking the literal interpretation of what a web OS might look like from a desktop perspective, but is looking at it from a higher level of abstraction to say, well, these components that would go up to make what an operating system might look like if it were out on the grid.
Right.
I mean, I'm just, so for example, there's identity, right? And then there's payment systems or currency or and then there's
storage of data and files.
Right, and then there's this and that and the other. And then there's all these kind of components that, as a developer, you don't want to build from scratch.
Right.
You want to reuse and leverage what's there.
That's right.
And then, you know, create something new and interesting over that.
Yep.
And that, you know, we've got these network layers, you know, I mean, we can look at the very base layer, TCP/IP, and these stacks of technologies. And I think there's these kind of little races going on.
That's right.
with companies wanting to be the provider in a particular area of that stack.
Sure, and you can see some obvious ones, and some may become sort of de facto standards if they're sort of left unchallenged, right? You know, in the payment world, you could have made the claim that, well, PayPal kind of carved that out. But then Amazon came along with the payment API and said, well, we're going to play that game too. So what you have then is not really what I would think of as an operating system, but more of a marketplace. And it's kind of like, you know, you can think of the hosted app systems today, something like Salesforce.com, where they have their own marketplace, and it's a sort of self-contained environment, things like that. But, you know, the idea behind sort of a web-scale version is that it's, you know, it's not hosted by anyone. It's hosted by whoever runs a particular service you want. It's your job to tie them together. And you end up with this big web marketplace of services. And, you know, I can't see it becoming anything close to what I would consider an operating system until it evolves quite a bit more. You need to have multiple providers offering things like storage. You know, Amazon's got S3. Well, who's going to have the next storage?
Well, relational storage. But
right.
Yeah, I agree with you. I criticize that from the same perspective as you would from a web OS perspective versus the web as a platform.
Right.
And made up of many platforms.
Right.
Interoperable, interchangeable, you can swap them in and out, and a healthy market of guys competing both in terms of increased functionality, better value, more usability, better support. We've seen it with these different, if you like, vertical platform pieces of the web.
Right.
There are definitely some guys, if you go to programmable web, it's interesting to see how certain APIs have dominated certain genres or types of services. And to see, well, what's it going to take actually to dislodge one of those guys with a new API? How long is that going to take? How long would it take to dislodge one?
And some of it has to do with, you used a really good word earlier, and that was interchangeable. And right now, even the competing services aren't interchangeable because their APIs often aren't the same. And even if they are similar, there are issues of identity and account management that come along too. But it'll be interesting to see how that evolves because, you know, you'll either need to have people agree on standards, and there has to be standards implemented for, you know, this is the standard way to do file-level storage or relational-level storage or web API.
Yeah.
Or you'll have services that spring up that try to abstract away all the differences of the data providers, sort of like ODBC on Windows did for all the relational databases for many years.
It's a provider.
You'll get the sort of web ODBC provider comes along and says, well, we know how to talk to, you know, the S3 storage engine, and we know how to talk to the MSN Live storage engine, and the Google storage engine, the Yahoo storage engine, and the, you know, whoever storage engine. And you write to our API, and then you can switch back ends and not have to be tied to any particular vendor.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the meta API providers.
Right, and it's like, are we going to see that, or are we going to see standardization? And I suspect we're going to see both, because those providers will have to exist to prove that there is enough need for standardization, right?
Yes.
So it'll be an interesting evolution. And I think when we get farther along that path, it'll start to feel more like a traditional operating system, at least from a developer's point of view, because you will have more interchangeable pieces.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It still seems like the coherency thing, though. The metaphor doesn't quite work for me still, because like desktop experiences, you were saying a moment ago, Alex, and I think Jeremy's also affirmed, there's like this coherency of an environment. You're kind of self-contained.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you've got this massive bazaar out there of all these different APIs and different services that are provided. And to bring those together into another constrained single coherent environment, or even multiple, I just don't see how the metaphor maps between them.
Yeah, that's why I like the sort of marketplace idea. I mean, I remember years ago when Sun kept saying the network is the computer, the network is the computer, and they came out with this cool idea, at least for big enterprises, was this whole Java card thing, where you walk into any terminal in your computer, in your company, you plug in your Java card, and it accesses a central server, and your sort of desktop is there. Like, all your stuff is there.
Hmm.
And that works really well in environments, well, some environments like that, I guess, because some companies adopt it and seem to really like it. But the reality is that sort of never took off on the broader internet, because people didn't really need that. What they wanted was just to be able to choose best-of-breed services, and their starting point was the browser.
This is my perception. You let me know where my perception may be wrong, is that the APIs have been orientated around more consumer, maybe apps for consumers, so that, you know, the hack days and the output that we're seeing around things, you know, from delicious APIs and all the various APIs that you have, had tended to have the output of consumer. And from what you were saying earlier around the Zimbro piece and the Yahoo Mail API, is my, I guess my question is, how do you think Yahoo has to play in the business-oriented APIs for the future? Is that something that you have a strategy for, you've articulated it, or you're working out and planning, or you're kicking to touch, you're not doing it at all?
Yeah, where are you at on that?
Well, it's a good point, because you know traditionally you haven't seen us in that sort of B2B world in any substantial way. I mean, we are primarily a consumer-focused company, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all of our content and services, for the most part, are targeted to people sitting at their desk or sitting at home and or sitting on their mobile device, and that's what we're good at. Now, that doesn't mean that we couldn't someday release more sort of lower-level building blocks to the web. You know, we could decide that we want to follow Amazon's lead and say, hey, you know what, there's something to this, you know, storage thing or to this image hosting thing or to this, you know, message queuing thing or whatever. You know, today you haven't seen any of that from us. Mm-hmm. And that's partly, I'm sure, because it's just not part of what we're used to building.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I think would be interesting is more along the lines of Hadoop, which is, you know, we've got a lot of interesting technology internally that has worked very well for scaling our own services. And, you know, it would be a worthwhile exercise for us to say, gosh, you know, what if those things are not sort of truly competitive advantages in the sense that if we gave them away, it would make us harder to compete in the marketplace. Could we do that in such a way where we either make the code available or turn this internal thing we've had into sort of a hosted app or hosted service for people?
Right.
And some of them would probably be developer-targeted services and not things that end users would be expected to understand.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that we sort of, you know, dream about from time to time, but
yeah,
you haven't seen anything launched yet, right?
Well, that, and I have seen that some stuff that was maybe would have been considered at first sight as a consumer-type service, like a Maps, gets quickly integrated into B2B scenarios.
Right, right.
As part of B2B from apps.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're doing, you know, some marketing to the business space or, yeah, just that's where I'm coming from. But
So there's just not, I mean, we haven't launched a lot of things like that. Mm. You know, I think there's another set of things. I mean, you do see some sort of next generation services that kind of cross several lines where we do some experimentation. I think the best example of that is with Pipes.
Hmm.
Because, you know, Pipes has the interactivity and feel of something that you could build for anyone to use.
Give a quick explanation of Pipes as you go into that.
I'll give you two explanations. One is for people who understand Unix. You know, Pipes is the idea of taking a pipe, which is a standard way of connecting small modular programs that know how to do one thing really well, putting them together in what you call a pipeline.
So piping more or piping less after a command is a real common Unix thing.
Yeah. So you take little tools that are good at one thing and chain them together to do interesting and novel things to a stream of data. And the idea was, well, we're seeing a lot of data appear in fairly standard formats on the web, so why hasn't anyone created a way to do the same thing on the web? And that's kind of what Pipes does, is it says, well, we're gonna create this platform that knows how to consume RSS and ATOM and CSV and TSV and a lot of these standard simple data formats,
mm-hmm.
and then put them into an environment where people can chain them together with all sorts of little tools that know how to do things like sort them and filter them and rank them and run them through a geocoder or put them on a map or dedupe them or lots of other things like that, or call out to other web services with them.
Okay, I get that explanation. Now, what's the explanation Alex will understand?
So the other version of that is to think about it from the end user's point of view, which is it's kind of like a web-based, you know, drawing board where someone can come in and put things on a canvas and kind of visually express what they want to do and then, you know, put boxes on a canvas and draw lines to connect them. And literally the data flows through those, follows the lines flowing from box to box and does the things the boxes say, like sort and filter and publish to a website or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to kind of visually represent this data flow process. And then interactively kind of drill in and configure it the way, you know, it's kind of like, it's hard to draw an analogy to anything because it is, there's nothing else really like it out there. But it's kind of like when, you know, Visual Basic first came out, it opened up programming to a whole new league of people.
Right.
You know, Pipes opens up kind of feed and data manipulation to a whole, or mashup creation to a whole other group of people.
Yeah.
Who don't necessarily have the programming skills but have the ideas. They're like, well, I know if I get this data feed from the Census Bureau and I can put this stuff on a map and I can run this against the geocoder and I can, you know, I can find, you know, real estate listings off this website, I can do this really cool real estate-ish kind of map thing.
Right.
But I don't know how. And, you know, they look at pipes and they watch a video or read a few tutorials and they're like, well, I might be able to get this done. And so it's a really interesting playground, I think, for trying out ideas with data. And new features are getting added to it all the time. There's actually a blog on pipes.yahoo.com that talks about all the new features and modules they're adding, and there's a gallery so you can see all the pipes that people have created. One of the original design goals there was to make it possible to kind of do the equivalent of view source on a pipe, so when you see someone who's something really cool, you can always see how they did it.
And have you had discussions around where open source falls into that? Because you're hosting the pipes, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, people can inspect it, you said, like a view source type thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's at least the openness of the code on that. But what kind of social networking around that sharing and those kind of things?
Yeah, it's just really basic now. I mean, there's no explicit what you would call a social network, but there's the ability to go in and look at all the pipes, see who created them, see which ones get run the most and which ones are the most popular and things like that. And you go from there. You find a pipe that's like what you want. You can clone it. There's the ability to clone a pipe and then start manipulating it. So the other thing you can do is we have the ability to create what I would call a parameterized pipe. So you create a pipe that's really, really useful at performing a service, like, you know, finding all the parks in a given zip code or finding all the Safeway grocery stores in a particular area.
Right.
And rather than building it just to work in a particular area, you can design it so it will take parameters as well. So that way it'll work for any zip code as long as the user punches in a zip code.
Very cool.
And so you're in a sense building up almost, you know, the equivalent of the sort of web feed subroutines that you could then integrate into other applications.
So does that become something that's RESTful then?
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
yep.
Interesting.
Yep. So you've got a URL where the parameter to go in, and you could then use that as a web service in something else you're building.
Yeah, nice. So you're doing this kind of this massaging of data before you get it out where something else can do something more extravagant or complex or whatever you need.
Right, right.
And how many developers have you got playing around with that today?
Gosh, I'd have to look. I mean, there's,
would you say six or more?
I'd say more. I mean, if I go to the browse the pipes, it shows me, like, I don't know, 10 pipes per page or something, and there's, well, how many pages are there? There's lots of them. There's at least 10 pages, so there's over 100 pipes in there. I suspect there's probably in the thousands, but I'd have to keep kind of clicking through to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can go past 14, so and I can just keep paging through it and see how many there are. But yeah, there are just hundreds of pipes that people have created to do interesting things out there. And the neat thing is that the pipe itself has access to a bunch of the Yahoo Developer Network APIs. So things like the geocoder, for example, that are really useful infrastructure services that you never, you know, that don't become widgets on websites or don't become visual things.
So you can make it obviously easy so that at least the Yahoo APIs become easily consumed.
Certainly, yeah. Exactly, and some of our own products, of course, become data sources, pipes. So if you want to grab a Flickr photo stream or something, we make that really easy to do, too.
Really good. Well, Jeremy, we really appreciate you taking the time with us to talk to us about pretty much everything under the Yahoo sun at this point. I think we've hit, about 40 different topics over this time. Not even sure if it'll all make it crammed into one episode or if we've got to break it into two. But we want to both Alex and I want to say thanks very much for taking the time with us and going through all of this.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for thinking of me and inviting me to do it.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Jeremy.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Do you want to do the outro on this one?
No.
You don't want to lead the outro?
What do you want me to say?
I don't know. Just some kind of wrap-up words, you know? This is the human interest part of the show. You, after the interview is done, you actually, you know, come away with something creative. Quick, on your feet. Be creative.
Oh. No. I've got it.
Well, yeah.
Shall I start now?
Yeah, go
All
ahead.
Right, okay. I thought that was a good conversation with Jeremy. Lots covered there. And I came across revisiting a cool site and service that you should try out if you don't already know, called Library Thing.
Library Thing.
Library Thing.
You don't remember the name?
It's called Library Thing.
Oh, okay. I thought you were getting all like Abbott and Costello on me.
And what you do is you tell this service what books you own. And
hence the name Library Thing?
Library Thing.
Okay.
And then you, you know, add tags and all the rest of it. But the cool thing about it is that once you've got it in, then you can get it out. So you can able to widgetize it, or they've got APIs, and there are ways to be able to export it just as a CSV.
Got capabilities for social sharing with your friends,
loads,
so that the people
loads.
Can like check out books from you or find out who's got
it. It's really cool. You can share the books of interest and compare and the like. And I came across it about a year and a half ago. I haven't played around it for over a year, but all my books are still there, and I've got a whole year's lot of books to bung back in.
Here's my problem with it right now. And let's see if it's actually a problem. Do they have a UPC reader so that I can take my book, scan it, and have it automatically entered into library thing? That way I don't have to enter all the titles and things like that.
Yes.
They do?
Yes.
I mean, that wasn't a setup question. That was just one of those things where it was like, I don't want to have to do a bunch of typing.
The answer is yes.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Neat. So you want me to do this? Why? You know I can't read.
Try it, because I like to know what books you read and see what you're up to.
My latest read is a book from 1994 called The Moral Animal by Robert Wright, and it's about evolutionary psychology. I highly recommend it.
Good.
What's yours?
Current read?
Yeah.
Alistair Campbell's The Blair Years. It's diaries.
Blair's project. Anyway, that's pretty much it for this episode. We'll see you next time.